Welcome to the 29th Annual Executive War College brought to you by The Dark Report. This year's conference was in beautiful New Orleans, April 30th through May 1st. The title of this presentation is Open Discussion, MolDX and Z-Code Update, Current Developments and What's Coming Next. The presenter is Gabriel Bien-Wilner, MD, PhD, Chief Medical Officer, Palmetto GBA, Columbia, South Carolina.
Okay, we're going to get started. Welcome, everybody. I am Regina Galloway from Ochsner Health System here in New Orleans. Welcome to our open discussion on MolDX and Z-Code Update, current developments, and what's coming next. This is Dr. Gabriel Bien-Wilner, and I told him I'd probably murder it because I have a horrible accent. He is the Chief Medical Officer for Palmetto GBA in Columbia, South Carolina. I might have to come visit you.
I will not be there. I live in Houston, Texas.
Okay.
My office is there, and it's usually empty. I think they've stolen my office, actually. I don't even think I have an office anymore because I don't go. So, hi, everybody. I'm, as stated, Chief Medical Officer Palmetto GBA. I'm the director of the MolDX program. Now we are spinning out the DEX registry and Z codes into commercial plans. We started doing that with Medicare Advantage plans starting in October of 2021. That process has been completed, and now we're focusing on non-Medicare services. This is where you may have heard about UnitedHealthcare rolling out these codes. I really thought that this session would be more of a Q&A, just engagement, kind of like the last one was, where if you guys have questions, I'm happy to answer them. I'm happy to answer any questions regarding A, policy, B, process, procedure, C, Z codes, and rolling them out to commercial plans or the structure of that. I know there's been a lot of angst from certain parties about that process. If anybody here did not see my earlier session, I kind of went over the overview of what the plan for that is or the promise of doing that. And really, I didn't only have 20 minutes. So it was, how much time do we have for this session?
You have until 3:35, so maybe minutes. Yeah.
All right.
I do have one question that was asked on the poll.
Well, I had a lot of questions earlier today too. So I would say, if you guys have specific concerns or questions you'd like to ask, just please go ahead and do so. We already have one, and I'm happy to answer any and all. I invite you guys to come forward so I don't have to scream. Although I have. I guess I have the microphone. And I was told I have to repeat your question because this is all being recorded.
Question
and no one will
Yankee.
Hear your question.
So,
all right, so the question was for non-MolDX states, they're having to get used to this process of submitting for Z codes because of UnitedHealthcare rollout. Will that impact in a positive way denials? I hope the answer to that is yes. The plan is the answer to that is yes. I'm going to talk through the strategy here and what the purpose of all of this is. And it is to mitigate these issues. I mean, so what are the issues? The issues are payers have very different processes, commercial payers particularly, they have very different policies. There's a great amount of discrepancy in reimbursement or coverage from payer to payer, even if they use similar sources for, you know, whether it's a third-party reviewer of, like, Hayes or something. It's kind of all over the place. One of the reasons I wanted to create this or spin out what we'd created for Medicare into the commercial space was really to address this specific thing. If all payers were starting from the same set of facts, from the same shared information that was agreed upon, would they be more likely to come up with the same conclusions regarding coverage? Would they be likely to have similar conclusions regarding payment? Would they have similar conclusions regarding, you know, the intended uses of certain services? And I could only assume the answer is yes. And so if they were to fully implement the program the way Medicare implements it, then absolutely the answer is yes. They would be automating adjudications based on what's in the data set. They'd be adjudicating at least pre-authorizations based on what's in the data set. Now, in practice, we can't, Palmetto GBA, by using this DEX registry and Z-codes, can't force the payers to do anything. We can't change their coverage policy. But we will hopefully get to a point where if we review a test and we believe through our rigorous process of performing technical assessments that is a good test for certain intended uses, it may be difficult for the payers to say, we don't accept this because we don't think it has value. I've yet to see a circumstance where I've written or our group has written a policy evaluating the evidence for a service, determined that that service has medical value, and then had somebody come to us and say, we don't agree. Or we believe you don't understand the evidence as well as we do. You know, our group, we have 5 molecular pathologists in the MolDX program writing policy. We have molecular geneticists. If I added up all the degrees, right, like there's nobody out there that has the sophistication we have to understand and write policy. We also, everybody that's a director in our group has run clinical laboratories, both in academic settings as well as in commercial settings, and often both. So we understand this stuff. We know how to run these things, and I think that gives us a huge advantage in writing sound policy, process, procedure, pricing processes. We can only hope that when payers have that same information, that they will leverage it to the best of their ability. Now, I understand commercial payers have an incentive to make money, but the argument that I make to the commercial payers is that you will save a lot of money and can still have more progressive payment strategies and policies by following the information at DEX Registry because they pay for a lot of garbage. You know, the problem is at a high level, from my perspective, is that, or one of the problems, there's many problems, right? That when a health plan, when a system, when the government looks at total costs, they see a big number. And they have usually very blunt instruments to deal with those problems. Oh, spending in laboratory went up 10% this year. Well, I guess we need to cut spending 10%, and everyone gets a 10% haircut. It's much easier to do that than take a surgical scalpel to figure out where the problems really are. I mean, I can tell you when we had very few controls. This morning I talked about infectious disease panels and, you know, how payers don't really understand. You can take a test and structure your claim in such a way to really hide what you're doing and really do abusive billing and testing practices. And when, you know, if no one pays attention, you know, payers pay for all sorts of things and they have to set conditions as to what they're willing to look at and how they're willing to control things and what's worth their time and what's not worth their time. When we expanded the MolDX program in 2022 to include molecular infectious disease testing, we had at that point recently hired the policy became into effect in April of 2022, but we started working on it a year earlier than that. Somebody who was an expert in infectious disease molecular testing, Angie Katsikas, who had run the infectious disease molecular laboratory at University of Chicago for 10 years. And I asked her, I said, under the scope of the program now, anybody who had a panel for infectious disease testing could be covered under the policy if they met the conditions of coverage under that policy. Whereas previously to that, it wasn't in scope of the program. We only paid for respiratory viral pathogen panels when they were 3 to 5 pathogens. That was the limitation. That was the only thing we paid for. And there were codes, I think 876.32 and 33, that were not covered that are respiratory viral pathogen panels greater than 5 pathogens. But people found ways all the way around a coverage policy that non-covered 876.32 or 876.33. They just used an unspecified single analyte direct probe technique times 10, and they were billing whatever. And they could just walk around because there were no real good controls. Now we're putting in really good controls. You're going to go through the process. You're going to submit for technical assessment like any other molecular test. And I said, Angie, how many tests do you expect to come this way? And she said, very few. Most labs use FDA-approved tests for infectious disease testing. There's only a handful of indications where there's any real sense to do this kind of work, these kind of panels. So I really don't think it's going to be more than, there were certainly some that she was expecting 6, 7. In the first month, we received more than 500 submissions. And it's because, I describe it this way. It's like when you go down to the basement, who has basement? And there's this box and it's been sitting there for years. And you don't know why it's there. And you pick up the box and there's like 1,000 roaches that scatter. Right? This is what it was. We had no idea. We had no idea to think that there was a problem. And now we have controls and processes in place to see that there's this horrendous mess. In fact, I'll tell you another fun story is when I saw that, this completely unexpected, I went on YouTube and I saw a YouTube video that this guy had made with like a Lamborghini in the background about how you can make a lot of money running these abusive laboratory tests that Medicare pays for everything, and it's easy to set up in a GU lab or in a GU practice, and that's like his job. He was like selling these kinds of, his group would like help you set up this laboratory, and you could just bill Medicare for all these things that were not at all medically necessary. That video was taken down. But anyway, the point is that I'm not telling you things that are specific to Medicare. And when I looked at I did a very conservative review of the claims data to see how big this problem was just in this space. I said, I want to look at panels of greater than X number of pathogens that have clearly no medical value. So we looked at all the ways that these things could have medical value and remove them from the analysis. Just even if they're improperly billed, it didn't matter. Just the conceptually for the right ICD-10 codes, for the right pathogens, what does the kind of dollars look like? And from 2018 to 2020, to the end of 2022, where I did the analysis, it was close to $2 billion were spent on services that we could not determine had any value whatsoever. And when you look at the private insurance companies, this is a long answer to this question. When you look at the private insurance payments, they are no different. You'd think that because they're private, Medicare is pay and chase, right? It's a honor system that it would be easier to get things through, and that's probably generally true in some settings. But the private insurance plans have the same problems. They're not any different. And so having these kinds of controls, my hope is that we'll let them pay for more sophisticated, quality laboratory innovative tests and still see savings, because you're going to take out this kind of noise from claims. And I'll tell you, the other major problem they have is just not that the services are improper, but they're improperly billed. They're improperly billed in a way where they're figuring out ways to some labs. And look, by the way, most labs are trying to do the right thing and bill properly. But the problem is those labs that are trying to do bad get a hugely disproportionate amount of the Medicare dollars and private payment dollars. So, when you give everyone a 10% haircut, it hurts everybody except the bad actors. It doesn't bother them at all. And so the right answer to me is to have a surgical approach and find ways of identifying the good from the bad and then only going after the bad. And then hopefully that frees up money to then pay for good. Now, can I promise you that United Healthcare will start paying for more? I can't. But I can hope that they see enough savings and enough value that they won't feel like, I'll tell you, in my conversations with people at United Healthcare and their policy writers, the biggest hurdle that they have is that they just don't understand what this is. And there's this hesitancy to pay for something that they don't understand. And again, having this sort of shared data to say, hey, these experts looked at it and they think it has value, we hope that will also be helpful. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Go ahead.
In the TA process, what's your view on submitting non-U.S. evidence?
So that's a good question. So I know that, you know, FDA may have a different take on this from what I've heard. I don't care if it's U.S. or non-U.S., provided that it's still representative of the patient population, you know, whoever it is. And it's also representative of whatever the health decision-making process is. So if you're using ex-U.S. data to demonstrate the clinical utility of some service and making some decision, and that decision-making process is fundamentally different in the Netherlands or whatever than it is in the United States, it's going to be difficult for you to make that case. You may be able to supplement that data with U.S. data, and it's not that we would completely throw it out, but, you know, the reality is you've, from beginning to end, to demonstrate clinical validity and clinical utility, you need a chain of evidence. As long as you complete that, as long as you convincingly demonstrate that there's not unanswered questions that would really determine that there is definitive evidence supporting the clinical validity or utility of that service, if you have to do it by combining 10 different things and there's a logical inference, that's fine. So we could definitely consider it, but it doesn't mean that it's equivalent.
I had a question from this morning about the factor 5 and factor 2 laden tests from Cepheid. So Dex said, no, you don't need a Z code for that. UHC said we do, and we were not sure how to proceed from there.
Sure. So I will say this, you know, the process of rolling out something new, it's not always perfect. There's always some bumps and hurdles, and it's not, and sometimes, unfortunately, you get caught in this sort of runaround. And we need to just have a solution to solving the runaround problem, and that is to come back to us and say, this is what United Healthcare says, and then we can come back and say, well, we can talk with United and figure out what the right answer is here instead of leaving you in some sort of limbo. So the issue is this. If it's a molecular test, which this is a molecular test, will it ultimately be in the scope of this program? Yes. But also, we're rolling it out on a CPT by CPT code basis. So are these tests defined by codes that are in those code set? If the answer is no, then we're not supposed to be doing those yet. That doesn't mean we're not going to do them. It just means for this initial phase. So it's not clear to me, based on your question alone, whether the answer is yes or no, but that, A, ultimately all the molecular tests will be, but we're rolling them out in a regimented way dictated really by United and how they want to proceed. And then if it is already in that list of codes, then the answer is we may have made a mistake, right? So I would say follow up with an email, but look closely at the announcement from United and the included CPT codes to make sure that the test as described does meet those criteria.
Thank you.
There's a question over there in the corner. Go ahead.
So I'll repeat the question. I think I forgot to repeat your Cepheid factor 5, factor 2 question, so I just now said it, so I think that counts. All right, so the question is plans for other payers. So the way that this system works, let me explain the business that we have here at Palmetto GBA around these things. So first, it's not the MolDX program. I'm going to say that again. MolDX is just Medicare, and this is now not Medicare. So we have this DEX registry, and we let people license it. Now, we created – at some point, we had to decide, when I came up with this plan to roll this out to non-Medicare providers or payers, are we going to be the ones selling this, or are we going to work with someone else? And the president and I sat down – not the president of the United States, president of Palmetto GBA. Joe Biden and I sat down, and we had coffee, and – so we decided that really it's not in our wheelhouse to actually sell this thing by ourselves. So we partnered with someone else who we thought could do it better than we could, and that was Optum. Software company, they're used to these licensing deals and reselling these kinds of services. So we entered an exclusive contract with them where they're the ones who resell access to our stuff. So the plan is certainly that other payers will license the use of this tool, and how they do so and with what and how they're going to use it ultimately will be up to them. But hopefully, again, like with United, that they fully leverage it in a way that benefits everybody. Let me tell you this. Raise your hand if you hate pre-authorization, right? Everybody, right? I'll tell you this. The payers also don't like it. The payers also know that it pisses you off. Now, they kind of benefit from the fact that, you know, you submit for pre-authorization. You do the test anyway because you can't sit on it, and the reagent may go bad, or if it's blood or something, you've got to use it or it goes bad. And they come back 2 weeks later and tell you, hey, you just test this not, you know, we deny your pre-authorization, right? So that benefits them because the work got done anyway and they didn't have to pay for it. Great. That's a win. But the reality is they know that it pisses everybody. Oh, sorry. Is that a bad word?
We curse a lot here in New Orleans.
Yeah. So oh, good. Okay. My kids told me the other day that I'm using the D word a lot. I'm like, what's the D word? Anyway. So anyway, the point is that that the payers also know it's a tenuous. Look, I can tell you how we got here, right? It's an evolutionary process that started with very few tests, and Medicare, because of pay and chase, we decided we had to create automated processes for claim adjudication because that we had no choice. Was the private payers were like, just a few of these. Let's just review the claim on claim-by-claim basis. Well, fast forward 10 years, and there's 100,000 tests out there. Or nobody even knows how many. And our solution now is great. Everything's automated. Perfect. And the private payers are stuck doing manual claim reviews and figuring things out on a case-by-case basis. And they know it doesn't work well. So I've never heard a commercial payer come to us and say, this is a terrible idea. Everyone I've talked to said, this is a great idea. This solves a lot of problems. So it solves problems for the payer. It solves problems for the provider. It solves problems for the patients. And so, yes, I hope, answer your question, I hope a lot of payers end up using it, but they have to license. And the other thing I'll say too is over this evolutionary process of getting to where we are, payers have created processes for handling these things, as inefficient as they may be. It's not easy to snap your fingers and change. It's not easy to say, yeah, our process is bad, yours is better, we're going to snap our fingers and then your processes will be in place. No, you've got to dismantle what you have. You've got contracts, you've got processes, procedures, you've got staff that do these things. You can't just undo all of that. So the cycle time, the sales cycle for this is very long. The deployment phases are really long and drawn out. I mean, we agreed with United Healthcare a long time ago to initiate this, and you've already seen it's been pushed back like at least two times, maybe three. And it's because operationally this is difficult to pull off. But if we can do it with United, we could do it with others.
The man with the sunglasses. No, that's you. Oh, you don't have sunglasses. Never mind. Thank you
for that. For MolDX specifically, what's your anticipation of other banks? Obviously not Palmetto, like rolling this out. Are they reaching out to you? They all wanted to do it together? Or do you ever have an idea?
Yeah, the question is for current MACs that are not in the MolDX program, do they want to take part in the program? I think some do, but again, when you speak about the MAC, you're talking about a large organization of thousands of people. I've talked to medical directors at other MACs who would be happy to be part of the program, and it makes their lives easier. I think it certainly does. Operationally, don't forget MACs are competing with each other for contracts from the government. That creates this weird scenario where MACs may do things that are probably against the interest of their providers and beneficiaries, but it benefits them from a sort of competitive perspective. I don't know. I do think there are certainly going to be directors at certain programs that think that they could do better than MolDX. They're clearly wrong, but I'm sure they think that. So So anyway, I would say, look, if you're in a jurisdiction that doesn't have the MolDX program and you'd like to be, reach out to the MAC, reach out to their contracting office, reach out to the directors, engage their interest. I know that there's been I've had those kinds of communications, and it's just, sometimes the directors aren't really in a place to make change for a large organization. They're not empowered to do so. So they may not be the right audience, but I think some would welcome it and some wouldn't, but it can't hurt to ask.
Want to go?
On foundational LCDs, what's your guidance on submitting for a request to revise a foundational LCD?
Sure. So thank you. So the question is, for a foundational policy, what are your thoughts about requesting a reconsideration to expand indicated use? So first of all our policies are foundational now. You will not see one that is not. I just don't see the value in spending the time and effort and resources to writing a policy that only services one provider. That's the way it used to be. It's not a good use of anyone's time or resources, particularly given under 21st century cures, how much more effort it takes to write a policy and how much more time it takes to write a policy. We are happy to review a policy and reconsider it if you have developed the evidence. So what are the requirements for A, requesting a policy, or B, requesting a reconsideration? Let's talk about what that is. Maybe that'll be helpful. So under 21st century cures, anybody can request a policy. What you need is just a handful of things. One is you have to ask us to write a policy. You have to provide the evidence. You have to tell us what the evidence is that supports the policy you would like to see. And you're supposed to suggest what the language of the policy should be. But when you present the evidence, that means actually submitting peer-reviewed published literature that supports your policy request. If you do all of those things under 21st century cures, we have to respond within 60 days whether you have a complete request for policy. And if you do, then you get on this queue for us to write policy. We have the option to immediately work on policy, but the reality is you go on a queue. And then we have no requirements to ever touch it again. That's just the way it is. But we have to put you in a queue, and that's very important. If there's an existing policy and you'd like to see it changed, then you don't ask for a policy. You ask for a reconsideration of policy. But it's the almost the exact same process, whereas instead of us telling you that you have a complete request for reconsideration, we tell you whether you have a valid request for reconsideration. But the requirements are all exactly the same. And so you need to have peer-reviewed published evidence that supports your position, and that's it. Those are the requirements. Now, if you have very strong evidence, or there's a great need, or there's an underserved population for, let's say there's a clinical problem for which there is no known existing parallel service that could be utilized, you would be sort of bumped up in the prioritization. So we have a prioritization schedule that's based really just on two factors. One is how long you've been sitting on that queue. And the other is how important we think this work is. Not to your financial health, but to like the beneficiary population at large. So let's say there's a known clinical need, and right now there is, doctors have to pick a therapeutic intervention and they have no basis for selecting one over another. And your test can help determine the right therapy that could really improve that patient care. That's going to get much higher priority than, hey, my test is just like this other one, but it's not technically under scope of your policy. Can you reconsider your policy to make it broader so that I can get paid also under that policy? Right? So we're going to weigh these kinds of things. Not that you're not valid. Not that you don't have a valid point. It's just that, you're not going to have the same urgency to develop or alter a policy. But the requirements are very minor. Now, if you have a lot of evidence, we may also bump you up because we know that this is not a waste of our time. If we write a non-coverage policy, in a way, it's a little bit of a waste of our time in that ultimately nothing will change in the way practices medicine or the medicine is practiced. Whereas if we write a coverage policy, or you know, most of our policies are not technically coverage policies, they're conditional coverage policies, that we're now introducing something new, and that's going to be more, that's going to be something we would rather do than to not write a coverage policy. So anyway, what else?
You stop. We'll do further.
So being new in this space, I work with a lab that has a test that has a PLA code. Mm-hmm. And because of that specificity of how they're written, are they included for Z code at this point? Or that requirement?
So the question is, if you have a PLA code, do you still need a Z code? And the answer is yes, because under the the MDT, the molecular diagnostic test policy, there's a requirement for that unique identifier code. So there's really no way around it under the MolDX program. I will say, let's talk about PLA codes, okay? So there are kind of pros and cons to a PLA code. Generally, most payers will simply never pay for a PLA code. And one of the reasons that that's the case is because when the AMA creates a PLA code, they explicitly mention that when they create a new code, it's because it's in, let's say, accepted practice, or labs do this kind of thing, so there must be some reason why they're doing it, that it has some sort of value, except for PLA codes, where they make no such assumptions or statements. And so they're basically saying, we don't know anything about this. We just don't think that there's another better code for this, and so we're going to create this specific PLA code. So it doesn't usually help from coverage, from a coverage perspective. It can help from like a payment perspective, in the sense that, well, we don't have to go into that, I don't think. But if you create a PLA code, and then you go through a technical assessment, and it's determined that not all the claims in the PLA code are correct or define what that test is, then you will not be allowed to bill with that PLA code. I don't know if that makes sense. Let's say you have a comprehensive genomic profile. By the way, there's a lot of codes for that now, but somehow AMA still writes PLA codes for tests that are comprehensive genomic profiles. And you say, our test does TMB, tumor mutational load, and MSI, and does 263 genes by hybrid capture on an Illumina platform or whatever. That's your test, and that's what your PLA does. Well, then you submit for coverage, and we look at your validation, and we say, hey, you didn't really fully validate this TMB. So you can't claim that you do TMB when you haven't demonstrated it actually works. Because this PLA code says it, you do TMB, and because we don't think you've actually demonstrated that actually meets the coverage criteria of a policy, you can't bill. You could maybe still do that test, and if you remove the stuff about TMB, but because the PLA code has that language in there, you can't bill with it, because it doesn't actually describe the service that's being rendered. So there's a lot. I mean, it's PLA is kind of a weird concept. It kind of breaks a lot of the rules of what CMS has entrusted the AMA to do with their code sets, and they're kind of problematic for a variety of reasons, but I can talk more about what that is if you have any more specific questions.
Can I add a comment to that?
Too? Yeah.
They're helpful, too, depending on what question you have. It's different for how you're thinking about it, but an ADLT, for example, if your test qualifies as an advanced diagnostic laboratory test, then potentially you might need to get a PLA code in order to finish that process. So there's more reasons, I guess, to consider that.
Well, I'll disagree. So the comment is that it can be helpful for ADLT. If you're in a non-MolDX jurisdiction, that's true. But if you're in a MolDX jurisdiction, it makes no difference, because we've covered ADLTs. Did I say the comment was that that PLA code can be helpful for ADLT process? If you're in the MolDX jurisdiction, you can get ADLT and bill with 81479. It makes no difference. the pricing process will effectively end up being the same, because that's the real benefit of the ADLT program, which is that the lab gets to decide whatever the market rate is for the first three quarters.
So that test is also required to report under PAMA every year. And if you're using an unlisted CPT code, you're not able to do that. So we've always been required to get a code outside of the C code for that ADLT in order to go through that process. That's why I mentioned that.
Okay, yeah, so PAMA requires for each CPT code to go through this price discovery for market rates. And 81479 is a NOC or not otherwise classified code, and therefore it doesn't go through that process. But I would argue that it's probably advantageous for most labs to not do that, because PAMA will also not reduce the rates of an 81479 code. So it's kind of a workaround in a way to this process that may reduce your rates, because they're contractor priced. So if we contractor price you favorably, you would effectively maintain that rate until we decide to change it. And we wouldn't decide to change a rate unless there's a very good reason to. Okay, so the question is, if a manufacturer comes and they're seeking a Z code, do they also need, or what guidance do we give around CPT codes? We usually actually don't give any guidance on that. That process is a very different process for a different intent. Because of Z codes, we're happy to cover things under NOC codes if that is the most accurate. When you submit a claim, let's talk about claims processing. And then let's talk about the specifics around being a manufacturer, because that's going to cause some issues there. The lab is supposed to bill with the most specific available code. Okay? The problem, and I talked about this a little bit earlier today, the problem is the code set's kind of messed up. It doesn't have any defined logic, and some codes are very specific, and a lot of codes are not at all specific, right? So because there's a lack of specificity in codes, some payers, some MACs will just say, oh, just use this other code. It's close enough, right? In fact, I was queried once by CMS how we address the problem when there's not a more specific code. How do you pick the next most specific code? Well, that defeats the entire purpose of the specificity of codes. So either there is a specific perfect match to that code or there is not. And if there is not, the most appropriate code for submitting a claim is the NOC code. Now, some manufacturers, some providers don't want to choose or use a NOC code. Why? In general, because that's a grounds towards getting non-coverage, or not non-coverage, non-reimbursement from payers. They falsely assume, I mean, based on some evidence, right, in some settings, that if you have a NOC code, you will not get reimbursed. But that is not true with the use of Z codes, which completely solve that problem. So we can know why. Why is 81479 sort of seen as like a bad word? It's the four letter code. It's because the payer doesn't know what 81479 means, and for them to know what it means looking something up and doing a bunch of work. So they just suspend all of that for some sort of review, and then they just flat out non-cover it and hope that you just go away. Right? That's kind of what happens. But with a Z code, we know exactly what you did. We know exactly if it's covered or not. And so it sort of eliminates that problem. If you're using this in a commercial setting, it's the same thing. So it would solve that problem as well. So if the task is for you to pick the most specific code, and there isn't one, then the solution is to use the NOC code, and that creates no conflict under the DEX registry or MolDEX. So we would never advise you, hey, there isn't a good code for you, go get one, because we don't really need one. Where there might be relevance to you is, well, you're not happy with the price, or you want, for some other reporting reasons, to have that code for PAMA purposes. But we wouldn't A, require you to have a specific CPT code, and B, it doesn't ultimately matter all that much when you have the Z code assigned to it, because we know exactly what it is, and we can determine whether it meets coverage criteria under policy without a more specific CPT code.
You were going to mention something about manufacturers.
Oh, right. So the question is, if you're a manufacturer and you're not running a laboratory, like you're not submitting claims, ultimately the person who submits the claim that needs the Z code is the lab performing that service. If you have a FDA-approved test such that everybody who performs that test performs the exact same test because everything is controlled, then there's only one Z code for that manufacturer. But if you have an RUO or you have a kit that then the lab needs to turn into an LDT, then every lab is a unique provider, they have a unique service in some way. And each one of those would need to have their own Z code.
Question back.
Sort of a setup, I don't have any questions, but you've obviously, your candor is great. You clearly recognize sophisticated steps that you're taking in order to determine coverage and Z code, so on and so forth. You've indicated multiple occasions you're talking to other MACs, you're talking to CMS. Why is it yet that it hasn't been just transitioned to whatever your determinations are? There's been a long time I've been waiting for that, and I just haven't seen it come. And it sounds like you're actually trying to work towards that.
So this is a great question or comment. Really wasn't any question in there. the comment / question is, why isn't the MolDX program a national program? And I don't really have a good answer to that other than to say CMS is not like Joe Biden sitting here making decisions, right? It's, we were having coffee yesterday and he said, let's make it a national program. It's thousands of people. And there's a lot of stakeholders and they have a lot of opinions on what's good and what's bad. Even within CMS national office, there's a bunch of subcomponents of the decision-making process. There's a contracting office. There's the policy office. They can all have different opinions. And I will tell you from my perspective what the issues are. So A, there is a vehicle for making this happen. So under 21st Century Cures Act, under PAMA, there was a provision to create a national laboratory MAC, which could sort of fulfill this criteria, if and when CMS chose to exercise it. So they've been thinking about exactly what you're saying for a long time. And do they have a valid model to make this happen? Yes, I believe the MolDX program is a great example of something that I believe works really well and most people really like. That said, there's a lot of other conflicts. So one is, the Medicare program was specifically designed where there's jurisdictions and there's MACs, and they have those jurisdictions with the idea that medicine is could be different. I don't know if this is true at all. In fact, it probably isn't. But that medicine is practiced locally, and so different jurisdictions could have different policy. So on one hand, you have this process that's created in the law, Title 18 of the Social Security Act, defines the program, the Medicare program, as this program administered by Medicare contractors that have different contracts in different jurisdictions so they can all be independent of each other. And on the other hand, you get complaints that, hey, why is it that people in this state have coverage and people in this state don't have coverage? So there's this inherent conflict. How can CMS allow Palmetto GBA to administer a national program and yet be a MAC that's supposed to be in charge of a regional thing when CMS has a national office for writing policy? So if you're going to make it a national program, shouldn't it be in CMS? Shouldn't it be a CMS-specific national office program? So I don't think they know how to answer that question. And so would the country benefit if this was a national program? I think so. But it's not such a simple, I don't believe it's a simple solution.
We have about 3 minutes left. You want to do one more question?
Yeah, and I'll say, you know, I'm around tomorrow, too. If you guys have questions and want to ask, I'm happy to answer them.
Can you get a Z code without submitting a TM? A lot of confusion.
Yeah, let me address that. So... Yeah. So this is a good question. This has come up a lot. Thank you. Yes. It was an excellent question. Can you get a Z code without doing a TA? All right. So let's talk about this rollout with United Healthcare. I'm going to give you an analogy here. Let's assume United Healthcare wants to fully implement the program. Using the DEX registry just like MolDEX. Let's say that was the goal. They have so many moving parts. There's so many different divisions. I talked about some of the challenges to implementation. Let's assume there's a light switch and there's 15 switches on that light switch and all of them have to be turned on to get to this perfect MolDEX-like solution. They're starting by flipping the first switch. And the first switch is, we just need the Z code on the claim. And then we'll go from there. Okay? Now the lab hears that and says, okay, that's all I need is the Z code. I'm gonna go to Palmetto GBA and register my test. And Palmetto GBA says, well, we're gonna do a technical assessment. And you're like, wait a minute. I just need a Z code. Well, the reality is that, you know, our process that we're gonna make everybody we're going to do is we're going to do everything the same for everybody, regardless of whether it's United Healthcare or Humana or Blue Cross Blue Shield, pick a state, or Medicare. We're going to review what you submitted. We're going to determine what the appropriate coding is for that service. We're going to perform a technical assessment. We're going to give you those results. We're going to do pricing if it's a NOC code, and we're going to put that in the registry. And then the payers are going to do whatever they want with that data. Hopefully they do good things with it. Right? Now, the first step is to give you that Z code. Sometimes we're always going to do the technical. We're always going to do the technical assessment right now. Now, there will come a time where we explicitly tell you, this hasn't happened yet, but this will happen for some services. There's going to be some services let me explain. When we do a technical assessment, we follow a very defined procedure for that kind of service, how we're going to evaluate the performance of that test and whether it meets clinical validity and clinical utility requirements. Think about all the infinite possibility of tests out there. We can't do it for every conceivable test. We're going to do it for those tests that are common. We're going to do it for tests that payers have a problem with. And they say, hey, we have a problem with these tests, right? And we'll create a process for handling those. But let's say you create some random test that only affects a very small group of patients in Idaho. And only then there's one family, there's one gene, there's one variant. It would be a waste of everyone's time and effort to create a very sophisticated, rigorous process for handling that. So as we get to this long tail of very rare esoteric tests, we're going to create a process where explicitly we're going to give you a Z code, but we're not going to do a technical assessment. Okay, but that's not what your question is. The question is, what about if I do one of these common tests, but I just don't want to do a technical assessment? Well, the answer is you don't have to. We're going to ask you to submit records. We're going to ask you to submit documentation. And if you choose not to submit that, you're going to fail the process. Now, what does that end up meaning to you and submitting claims to your payer is your problem and your payer's problem. But we're still going to try to complete the process. Because ultimately, I believe that the payer will likely say, okay, now you need to have a successful technical assessment.
Well, thank you all for your questions. We're at time. There were 4 poll questions submitted, so I guess you can take some time later and answer
sure.
them for your audience. And you said you'd be around tomorrow if anybody has any other questions. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, guys.
This concludes the presentation. Please visit the Executive War College website for details on the 2025 event.